The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. And today, the veteran I had lined up couldn't make it. And so I'm going to give you a little potpourri, a little bit about myself, and a little bit about what's going on in the Air Force, reading from Air Force Magazine. But my name is Frank Urban, and I was in the Air Force for 22 years. I'm a Raleigh boy, went to school, elementary school at Our Lady of Lourdes off Anderson Drive there. And then in ninth grade, I went to Daniels Middle School. Back then it was called Daniels Junior High. Now it would be Daniels Middle School, and I understand they're getting ready to change the name to Oberlin School or Middle School because it sits in the historic Oberlin District of Raleigh. I am a Raleigh boy. I went to high school at Broughton, and then I went to college at North Carolina State University, majoring in speech communication. And during my time in college, I worked at various radio stations. The big top 40 station in Raleigh was WKIX, Kix. And I worked at the Kix Wannabe, WRNC, which played the same music as Kix. And we wanted to be Kix, but we weren't. And then when I got to be, I think about my junior year in college, I got a summer part-time job at Kix doing news, which I absolutely loved. And at that time, there were 7 full-time news people at Kix. Me and 2 other guys were part-timers on the weekend, which would be unheard of now because radio is not making enough money to support that many people. But that was in the heyday of Big Kix. And also worked a little bit at WPTF and started off working in radio over in Smithfield at WBZB. So that's a little bit about me. Then I came into the Air Force and worked in audiovisual, which at that time equated to working in a video production studio where we made videos on all kinds of things, from basic fighter maneuvers for the fighter weapons school at Nellis Air Force Base to when I got to Hill Air Force Base. Hill is a huge industrial complex. All the landing gear of all the planes in the Air Force go through there for refurbishment. All the C-130 aircraft go through there. And all the F-16s go through there for breakdown and heavy maintenance, where they break it down and put it back together. And there was a time in the early 80s where women were, you know, relegated to the administrative jobs. And so Hill Air Force Base leadership had made a commitment to helping women get out of the administrative field if they wanted to, and to be able to make a better salaries working in what was called the wage grades. These were the people who worked on the aircraft. And when I talk about a big industrial complex, there was one building that had 72 F-16s in it, and they were in various stages of refurbishment. And you go in there at that time, and it was all men, but you go in there now, and it's going to be half or more women. And the building's so big, they're riding around on bicycles and golf carts and doing their jobs like that. In order, this is a long way of getting around to what I started to go into with the video production. We made videos about tools, each tool, like a torque wrench, how to use a torque wrench. Now, even most guys don't know that unless they're really into things. But we made videos, simple videos, on every tool so that women could learn how to use these things and be able to get a higher paying job. And it's very, very, very successful. And, of course, now the whole military is every once in a while you hear about the first woman this or first woman that, but it's very, very much a mixed world. probably the most diverse organization in the world, really, if you wanted to look at it that way. So I had a hand in that, making those videos and also making videos for the Fighter Weapons School. One that also stands out in my mind, there was an airplane called the F-111 that flew very low to the ground and could sort of, if you will, sneak up on the enemy. And in case the crew, it was a two-person crew, in case they needed to eject, the seat didn't just eject, but a whole module ejected. And so in order to show them how it worked, we actually ejected a module out of the plane and had it hanging by a crane and then dropped it so that they would see what would happen if they had to do that for real. And these big air pillows came out automatically and helped them land softly. So that's a little bit about what I did. And then I always wanted to be in public affairs and where you deal with the media a lot. And so the second half of my career, I did public affairs and really enjoyed that. I was the first director of public affairs for the Air Force Special Operations Command, and that was quite exciting at that time. We did have one of the biggest air losses of the first Gulf War in the Iraq-Iran area. We lost a C-130 gunship. It was a very sad situation, so I handled all the public affairs for that with the media. Had a lot of big media interest, as any accident does, air accident. So now I'm going to read to you about our new Chief of Staff of the Air Force. This is called Questions and Answers, What's on the Mind of General C.Q. Brown. The Air Force announced General Charles Q. Brown Jr.'s nomination to become Chief of Staff in March. Chief of Staff of the Air Force is the top guy. That's the top of the pyramid. Just days after Air Force Magazine news editor Amy McCullough and editor-in-chief Tobias Nagel caught up with him for an interview during the Air Force Association's Air Warfare Symposium in Orlando, Florida. Once confirmed, Brown will become the 22nd Air Force Chief of Staff, replacing General David Goldfein. His comments have been edited for space. And he is the first black Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And he stands quite tall, but very interesting guy. The National Defense Strategy, this is a question. The National Defense Strategy focuses on the pivot to the Indo-Pacific. How do you change the playbook to make that happen, and what kind of progress are you seeing so far? And his answer, part of it is education. And what I mean by that is the decision maker and policy makers have to have a better understanding of the Indo-Pacific theater. Because of what we've done over the past 25 plus years since the Cold War in Europe, and in our alliance with NATO, we have a comfort zone there. I don't know that the Indo-Pacific is an area that is well understood. The more we have decision makers come out and visit the region and get to know the partners there, they will have a better appreciation of the region and how we need to look at the threat as well as our partners. It's not one size fits all. The size of the region is roughly 5 times the size of the U.S. European Command area of operation. But then you have different dynamics in the AOR. You know, Japan, Korea, Mongolia, and a bit different from India, which is at this other end of the spectrum, or Australia and New Zealand. The other difference we have there, too, is that our economies are pretty well intertwined. If you look in the region, a large percentage of the world's population is in the Indo-Pacific. Question, what impact is China's relationship with its neighbors play in the region? The Russians aren't economically intertwined with a lot of things that are going on in Europe, not like the Chinese across Asia. You've heard people talk about cooperate where you can, compete where you must. Economically, there is a level where cooperation can occur. Question. You've cited increased military cooperation between Russia and China in the past. Is that still an issue? I don't know. I think they'd be hard-pressed to have a strategic relationship, partly because I don't know that they have the same outlook on the geopolitical aspects of what's going on in our region. They have exercised together, but they don't exercise like we do. You could probably describe it as exercising in the same region, same day, parallel play, less integration. We're much more integrated and operable with our partners than they are. The other part is, because I've asked this question rhetorically, who's going to be the junior partner? Because I don't think either one of them wants to be the junior partner. You don't necessarily have to have a junior partner, but you have to have an understanding of the relationship between the two. That was a little bit of the nerdy part. Here's a picture of an HH-60 Pavehawk helicopter from the 56th Rescue Squadron soaring over Aviano Air Base, Italy. And it's a beautiful scene. The aircraft with the town below at the bottom of the mountains. And then up above, you can see a beautiful silhouette of the mountains with snow on top and a blue sky in the background. The all-weather search and rescue unit relocated from Lakenheath, UK, to join the 31st Fighter Wing based at Aviano in May 2019. The Air Force announced in February that the Pavehawks are slated to be replaced by HH-60Ws. The new helicopter will be dubbed Jolly Green 2 in honor of the Vietnam-era HH-3E rescue choppers, known as Jolly Green Giants. The F-35 Lightning is the latest fighter jet, and there's a double-page picture of it at night, and it's really beautiful. The aircraft there with, you can tell it's a slow shutter speed because the people are kind of blurry, but the aircraft itself is sharp. And it says, an F-35A Lightning II on the ramp at Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada in February. The jet is among 78 F-35s operating out of Hill, that is Hill Air Force Base, in four operational squadrons. The Air Force is seeking 48 more F-35s in its 2021 budget request, well short of the 72 required per year the Air Force has said are needed to rejuvenate the fighter force with fifth-generation stealth and sensors. Next is an article called Strategy and Policy. What are Putin's five new nukes for? And there's a picture of a missile launching. And the caption says, a frame grab from a Russian Ministry of Defense video shows the new Sarmat heavy intercontinental ballistic missile as it undergoes its second test launch at the Plesk Cosmodrome in northwest Russia on March 30, 2018. The Sarmat is part of Russia's new arsenal, announced in 2018 by President Vladimir Putin. Russian President Vladimir Putin made a grand announcement in March 2018 declaring that Russia is developing five new nuclear or nuclear-powered weapons. The new nukes would be in addition to Russia's extant START-compliant strategic nuclear forces and thousands of non-strategic nuclear weapons, ranging from torpedoes to artillery and short-ranged missiles. Russia's existing nuclear force already holds the U.S. at risk. These new weapons wouldn't appreciably change the nuclear deterrence equation. So why does Putin need them? The Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security took up that question in conjunction with experts from Los Alamos National Laboratory. In a March report, Russia's exotic nuclear weapons and implications for the United States and NATO, 28 strategic arms experts confess they're still scratching their heads. It's hard to see the rationale for expending so much Russian treasure on a prodigious nuclear and modernization program that doesn't really give Russia more capability than it already has. Perhaps the most plausible rationale could be a genuine paranoia about the vulnerability of Russia's nuclear deterrent and a desire to signal Russia's great power status to foreign and domestic audiences. A second would be a desire to overwhelm the U.S. and allied theater missile defenses. A third, that the new weapons could be used as coercive measures in a crisis. Now, I know the public doesn't follow this stuff closely, and we don't like to think about nuclear war, but I'm glad that we have smart people who are thinking about it. And we have articles like this to help anybody who's interested to read about it. Russia's new nuclear weapons are Sarmat replaces the SS-18 heavy ICBM codenamed Satan by NATO. It can carry either 10 reentry vehicles or at least one hypersonic glide vehicle. Russia has said it will begin production of Sarmat this year. Plans call for 6 Sarmat regiments, the first to be deployed in 2021. Avangard hypersonic glide missile is second. This is a very long-range, maneuverable weapon that would be difficult to defend against. It would be pushed to hypersonic speed by Sarmat, eventually in the near term. Sarmat successfully in 2016 and 2018 was tested and activated 2 of them in December. Third, Kinzhal hypersonic missile. This weapon would be carried to an altitude by wing pylons or in bomb bays. Russia has boasted about having developed such a weapon before the U.S. And fourthly, Burevestnik. Nuclear-powered long-range missile, Putin claims this weapon has unlimited range. Codenamed SSC-X9 Skyfall by NATO, its existence was disclosed in 2018 when Putin showed a video animation of the missile traversing huge distances on a map, crossing Europe, the Atlantic Ocean, and parts of South America before approaching a target in Florida. Russia claims the weapon features a low radar cross-section. And fifth, the Poseidon. It's a nuclear-armed autonomous underwater drone, previously known as Status 6. 6 of these torpedoes could be carried by a Russian-guided missile submarine. And the EU's capability deficits. The fundamental problem is that military assets are limited. If the U.S. is suddenly faced with a conflict in the Asia-Pacific, it may have no choice but to move ISR, mobility, and other assets out of the theater where they have historically been available, sounding a wake-up call to allies that have grown too reliant on those capabilities. Going to another article, U.S. Air Force rebuilds munition precision munition stockpiles, and it's got a picture of an F-15E Strike Eagle armed with a variety of Joint Direct Attack munitions on a May 7, 2019 mission over Southwest Asia. Production's surge slows as Air Force nears weapons goal. After an intense period of restocking, Air Force precision weapon inventories are almost back to acceptable levels, Air Force leaders say. Now they're throttling back planned purchases for fiscal 2021. We have been able to make a dent in the munitions shortage, said General Arnold Bunch, Jr., head of Air Force Materiel Command, during the Air Force Association's Air Warfare Symposium in February. The sharp reduction of U.S. air attacks against the Islamic State group has allowed us to get in a better place and on a better trajectory in terms of war reserves, the general said. He went on to say, what I would hope we would do is level off at this year's level, maybe plus or minus a little bit. Here's an article. Elon Musk, best known for the Tesla electric automobile, says the fighter jet era has passed. Elon Musk tells the Air Force autonomous drones are the future. With 6 words, Elon Musk sent a shudder throughout the great hall in which thousands of airmen and aerospace industry officials had gathered to hear his comments at the conclusion of the Air Warfare Symposium that we talked about earlier. The fighter jet era has passed. First came a moment of silence, then a rolling murmur, reporters tweeted, Chief of Staff General David Goldfein, seated in the front row, sat up straight, then leaned in to hear what followed. The rumble died down. Locally, autonomous drone warfare, Musk added, is where the future will be. Then he said, I can't believe I'm saying this because this is dangerous, but it's simply what will occur. Musk also told Lieutenant General John Thompson, commander of the Space and Missile Systems Center, in a lengthy on-stage interview, that Lockheed Martin's F-35 would benefit from a competitive Challenger. The competitor should be a drone fighter plane that's remote controlled by human, but with its maneuvers augmented by autonomy, Musk said later that day via Twitter. The F-35 would have no chance against it. Musk has long been known for bold and dramatic promises. He swore his Tesla car company would produce 500,000 cars per year in 2018 and barely hit half that number. He promised fully autonomous cars, but despite effective self-driving capabilities, has yet to achieve that vision. And he announced he had the funding to take Tesla private in 2018, only to get sued by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Yet, Musk has also proven to be a visionary, creating a market for electric cars with Tesla and a viable space launch vendor with SpaceX. His comments underscore his prediction for sweeping predictions as well. His comments underscore his predilection for sweeping predictions as well as long-standing tension between backers of manned and unmanned aircraft and the rapid advance of Air Force concepts for drone warfare. He's hardly alone. Advocates for unmanned and autonomous systems have trumpeted the end of manned aircraft for more than a decade, even as the Air Force had brought online its newest, and some suggest last, manned fighter jet, the F-35, which will remain a centerpiece of its combat aviation forces for the foreseeable future. Air Force leaders argue it is more beneficial to keep a person in the cockpit because the algorithms that would let an aircraft think on its own aren't sufficiently mature yet, not to mention the ethical dilemmas that come with waging war without a human present. Qualified fighter pilots must be able to master highly aggressive three-dimensional maneuvering rates exceeding twice the speed of sound in a highly dynamic battle space, operate highly sophisticated mission equipment, and face adversaries doing everything in their power to kill them, Doug Berkey, executive director of AFA's Mitchell Institute, wrote in a recent op-ed. The distant promise of autonomy must not be confused with meeting the clear and present threats of today and tomorrow. But even the four-star general in charge of sending fighters into battle acknowledged that the businessman had a point. The Air Force will need manned fighters and bombers for a long time, but will run more and more experiments to try out other options, Air Combat Command boss General Mike Holmes said March 4th. ACC's fighter roadmap charts a 30-year path forward. The next addition to the fleet may not be a conventional fighter. Rather, the Air Force is trying to define a requirement around a capability instead of around a specific sort of platform. For now, the best option is to continue replacing fighters with fighters, like continuing to add F-35s and bringing on the updated fly-by-wire F-15EX as F-15Cs age out of service. The next decision point I have is when the Block 30 refers to a upgrade of an aircraft, and the older F-16s when they need to be replaced. What am I going to replace them with? I want to work to do the experimentation to answer that question, Holmes said. Will I still want to replace them all with F-35s, or will I start cutting into something else, like Elon talked about, or like Air Force Acquisition Chief Will Roper and I are discussing? For the foreseeable future, however, both manned and unmanned platforms will be in the mix. F-35s may be the quarterback in combat, calling the plays, but the rest of the team will include remotely piloted and manned platforms. Adding autonomy into combat is a harder problem than it may seem. We've done really well at teaching some artificial intelligence machines to play complicated games, Holmes said. But they're playing games where they know 100% of the information. When you're playing a game where you have uncertainty, you don't know everything. Then there's still a role for people to play, whether that's in the cockpit of a fighter or whether it's in the command and control center. Even as the Pentagon and industry make strides in unmanned technology development, the ability to take direction from fighters is often at the core of those ideas. Jumping over to a sidebar titled USAF 2,100 Pilots Short, the Air Force is still 2,100 pilots short of its 21,000 pilot target, indicated the end to the pilot shortage is still not in sight. Pilots continue to leave military service for better-paying civilian jobs with greater flexibility at airlines and elsewhere. The pilot shortage has remained relatively steady for the past several years. Pilot production is up 30% over the past 4 years, according to Vice Chief of Staff General Stephen Wilson. He said the Air Force produced about 1,000 pilots in 2015 and 1,300 in 2019. The goal is to turn out 1,480 aviators a year by fiscal 2024. Between all the services, we're going to produce 2,200 pilots, and the airlines are going to hire 5,000, Wilson told lawmakers in March. We, too, are concerned on being able to produce the number. But then the next part is I've got to be able to season them with the right flying hours. Then I've got to retain them on the back end. Pilot training has largely unchanged over the past 50 years, despite huge strides in technology. Meanwhile, today's airmen are smarter than any group of airmen the service has ever seen, Wills said, and better able to access multiple channels of information simultaneously than in the past. It's an imperative for us to transform. Well, we've run out of time for this month's Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. This is Frank Urban. I hope you've enjoyed the program today. Please call us with your comments at 919-832-5138.